Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
Friends without benefits. It's still not clear if Donald Trump will make good on threats to pull federal funding from New York City, but former Mayor Bill de Blasio tells us he's not really surprised the president found a lot to like in his political foe, Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani.
And vinyl resting place. After Joe Bassard died, it wasn't clear what would happen to his incredible collection of rare records. But now it's all online. The archivist who made that happen tells us what it was like to listen to those records with the man who had rescued them.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Friday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Harmony Food Co-op in Bemidji, partnering with local farms for over two decades to provide fresh and local foods, promoting sustainability through local buying, open daily from 8 to 8, or at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. Do you rely on KAXE? Are you at least 70 and a half years old? Supporting KAXE's future is easy. Ask your financial advisor to set up charitable IRA distributions to KAXE. Questions? Call Chris at 218-326-1234. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is Coulter Wall with the song Summer Wages.
Never hit 17 when you play against the dealer, for you know that the odds won't ride with you. Never leave your woman alone when your friends are out to steal her. She'll be gambled and gone like summer wages. And we'll keep rolling on till we get to Vancouver, and the woman that I love, she's living there. And it's been 6 long months and more since I've seen her. She may be gambled and gone like summer wages. In all the beer parlors all down around Main Street, the dreams of the season get all spilled down on the floor. And the big stands of timber waiting there just standing by the door. So I worked on them old towboats with my slippery city shoes, which I swore I would never do again. In the gray, fog-bound straits where the cedars stand watching, I'll be far off and gone like summer wages. Dreams of the season get all spell down on the floor. And the bed stands a timber, waiting there just for falling. The hooker's waiting watchfully, standing by the door. Never hit 17 when you play against the dealer. For you know that the odds won't ride with you. Never leave your woman alone. When your friends are out to steal her, she'll be gamble.
And that's Summer Wages by Colter Wall.
Years are gamble.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
opposites retract. After months of mutual criticism, New York Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani and U.S. President Donald Trump have a surprisingly warm meeting. Bill de Blasio tells us he knows why Trump was impressed by the man he once called a communist lunatic.
Out of the shadows, a survivor of abuse by Jeffrey Epstein explains why she took on Donald Trump and Congress to secure a promise that files on the serial predator would finally be released.
For non-starters, given the serious concessions it demands from Ukraine, that country's foreign affairs chair says it's hard to believe the American-led peace plan is meant to be serious.
Wildest nightmares. After a horrifying grizzly bear attack in BC, a woman from Bella Coola Valley tells us about her own grizzly encounter, which convinced her a tragedy like this was only a matter of time.
What goes around and around comes around. A legendary collection containing some of the rarest vinyl records in the world is now accessible to all online. We'll hear about it and hear some of it.
And Dark Night of the Soul. Psychologists find people become more altruistic when a growly costumed vigilante shows up, a phenomenon they call the Batman effect. As it happens, the Friday edition. Radio that knows some science is beyond our capabilities. Just a couple of weeks ago, in his rousing victory speech, Zohran Mamdani, a mayor-elect of New York City, said this.
Donald Trump, since I know you're watching, I have four words for you. Turn the volume up.
But today, when the mayor-elect met face-to-face with the president, both men turned the volume way down. Despite having repeatedly called Mr. Mamdani a communist and a lunatic, and endorsing Andrew Cuomo in the New York mayoral race, Mr. Trump struck a genial tone today, saving his jabs for a former mayor of the city.
I expect to be helping him, not hurting him. A big help, because I want New York City to be great. Look, I love New York City. It's where I come from. I spent a lot of years there. Now I'm right here. We took a big setback with a mayor that we had, named de Blasio. I thought it was a tremendous setback for the city. I think this mayor can do some things that are going to be really great.
Bill de Blasio served as the mayor of New York City during President Trump's first term. We reached him today in Tucson, Arizona.
Bill de Blasio, the U.S. president, as you know, rarely resists an opportunity to take a jab. But were you expecting to hear your name come up?
He seems to bring it up quite a bit. I consider it a badge of honor. And it's so ironic because Mamdani has said very openly he wants to emulate a lot of the things I did in office. And we're, you know, obviously I was a strong supporter of his. And I love Trump's sort of shape-shifting ability to just see whatever he wants to see. But I'll take it as a compliment, and I'm glad that somehow they seem to be getting along.
Yeah. To what do you attribute the warmth of this press conference and the warmth that Donald Trump appears to be showing towards Mayor-elect Mamdani?
There's a great phrase from the streets, game respects game. Mm-hmm. I think Trump, with all his contradictions, and obviously I thoroughly disagree with Trump on almost every issue, but I do think when he sees someone who's a great communicator, a strategic thinker, he has respect for that. And Mamdani has basically taken everyone to school. on how to run a campaign as a progressive that can win. I think there's also the reality that Trump is hurting deeply right now. I mean, the economy is not working. He is losing popularity constantly. The Epstein files are a huge problem for him. He's trying to distract, and he's trying to seem, I think, a little more reasonable at times, because the American public is clearly responding poorly to his extremism. So this is a great, you know, kind of Nixon goes to China moment for him. That said, in a way, Mamdani didn't have a lot to lose. If they seem to get along, and Mamdani is a very charming person, that's in some ways a feather in his cap, because it shows he can work with anyone, and that's going to be probably calming to certain elements in New York City. But on the other hand, if Trump had full-throated attacked him, a la Zelensky, a lot of people who supported Mamdani would have felt very good about that. They would have felt that was an affirmation. So maybe the only danger was to seem too cozy or too close, but I don't think that was really going to be a particularly likely scenario.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you if there is a danger for Zohran Mamdani, because he campaigned as someone who would stand up to the president, are you worried that it could alienate people who supported him?
I'm not, for the reason that I think, you know, we don't want Trump to try and disrupt New York City. It's a battle I think we ultimately win, but it's messy. It takes up a lot of time and energy. If this is a way of helping to back Trump off, then that has real material value. So a certain amount of diplomacy, if it allows more space for Mamdani to pursue his program, is a good thing. But I don't think there's anything that suggests that, you know, if Trump crosses a line, Mamdani is going to do anything but fight back.
And the possibility of federal funds being cut off by this U.S. president is still very much a reality, a possibility, right, for New York?
Well, I'll tell you something. He tried it in my administration. Trump tried to cut our security funding, the money we actually used to fight terrorism, because he claimed we were a sanctuary city. And we beat him in court. And I think, in fact, when you look at the court cases on this issue, there was a decision by Justice Roberts actually over a decade ago that said the federal government cannot withhold funding because of policy differences once it's been authorized by the Congress. So I think the city of New York's in a really strong legal position. So I think it's more, you know, bark than bite here.
You can certainly relate to that kind of one-on-one meeting. It's just about just under a decade ago that you met during Trump's first term in office while you were mayor of New York City. You were both critical of each other publicly as well. Did you speak to Zohran Mamdani about that experience and how to navigate his own?
We had conversations over the last few months about my reality dealing with Trump, you know, generally having to fight him. Sometimes, particularly during COVID, obviously it was in the city's interest to try and find some common ground. And, you know, I went to see Trump about 10 days after his original election in 2016, and knowing I fundamentally disagreed with him, but hoping he would moderate. And obviously that proved not to be the case. But, you know, at least trying to see if there were some areas of agreement. And I think it's a good thing to do so long as you maintain your clarity about what you stand for. But in the end, you know, Trump is all over the place. I mean, even during COVID, I had days when he was reasonable and helpful and other days when he was absolutely unclear. And so I think, you know, trying to have a rapport is smart. Believing that rapport is going to work on any sustained basis is kind of a fool's errand.
And just before we let you go, I wonder what you think all of this might signal to maybe conservatives who are not supporting Zohran Mamdani as they watch this interaction and this meeting. What might it signal to them?
Well, I truly believe it was an attempt to distract from the Epstein file situation. So I think one of the things that's happening is a lot of conservatives, a lot of folks in the MAGA movement are beginning to lose faith in Trump. So this is not helpful on that level. I mean, I think Trump looks for any kind of, you know, shiny thing to go after that will help distract, because he's losing ground so clearly politically. But I do think that further alienates his base, and that's his, you know, ultimate danger. So in the end, I'm not sure this was a good move for Trump. I think it was the right thing for Mamdani. I'm not sure it's going to have a good lasting impact for Trump. But I also think his game plan was just to jump at anything he could to get attention off of Epstein. And, you know, one more point since we're talking. You know, for a while, he loved talking about your nation in a derogatory and inappropriate way.
I'd almost forgotten.
yeah, but it's a really great example of that. Yeah. For a while, that was all he talked about. Yeah. Then thank God, your prime minister won the election and stood up to him, and then Trump moved off. And I think that's the reality. When you stand up to him, and Mamdani will, absolutely, he moves on to the next thing. He looks for where the weak point is. And I think Canadians in general, really, I have tremendous respect for you, the way you stood up to him, and he moved on.
Bill de Blasio, I appreciate this. Thanks for coming on the show.
You're very welcome. Take care.
You too. Thank you.
Bill de Blasio is the former mayor of New York City. We reached him in Tucson, Arizona, and we did double check. We did have the right Bill de Blasio. They had just stopped for lunch when a grizzly bear attacked. Yesterday afternoon, a bear attacked a group of students and teachers at Akasalta School, an independent school run by the Newhawk Nation in Bella Coola, British Columbia. Today, that school was closed. On its social media account is a post that reads, "It's hard to know what to say during this very difficult time." Bella Coola Valley is no stranger to grizzly bears, which Tanis Monroe knows all too well. Last month, a mama bear and her two cubs broke into her house. We reached Tanis Monroe today in Toronto.
Tanis, you know very well what grizzly bears are capable of, but even given that, were you surprised by the scale of this bear attack in Bella Coola?
I mean, I was horrified. It's awful. And yeah, absolutely. And the fact that children were involved is pretty terrifying. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, I think everyone who's read the story and seen the headlines, and they've gone all over the world, feel that same sense of shock.
Yeah.
But was there also, I wonder, for someone who has experienced what you did, that a concern that something might happen, something else might happen?
Without question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, without any question. We had actually mentioned that, as you know, there's a strike going on, so our conservation officer was really overworked and getting a lot of calls and one person on, and he was working like crazy. And so he had an RCMP officer working with him, and they have to prioritize what they're doing and where they're going. There's only two traps in the entire valley to use. They had to figure out what the best thing was to do. But we, you know, given the devastation to our home, we really said that it would only be a matter of time before there will be a human being involved in this, and the person could easily be killed. I mean, it's just a matter of time.
You said that to them.
Because the bears kept, and they agreed, actually, and because the bears continued to come back. They didn't just come one time. They came back again and again.
Just to go back a little bit, you weren't home, thankfully, when the grizzlies broke in last month. What did you find when you did come home?
So we were there, and it was actually just my husband who was there a day after they had come. And so he boarded up the door. So, I mean, what we found was the place had just been devastated. We actually have two modest places, a trailer and then a cottage. And both of them had been, the bears had gone in and torn everything apart and, you know, dragged stoves and fridges around and across beds, et cetera. And, you know, then he had to sleep there with just, you know, some 2x4s between him and the bears that could have come back.
What did the conservation officer you spoke with at the time, you said they agreed with you that this could be, you know, more dangerous and deadly in the future, but what did they tell you about what they could do?
They were doing what they could do, so they can set a trap. There's some hesitation, like the words used to me by the RCMP officer and the conservation officer was that they were being watched like a hawk, i.e. it's very difficult to be able to go after a bear because we've got to be absolutely sure that it was that bear, that very bear that we're going to trap, that was the one that broke in. Now, you know, with some logic and some knowledge of bears, and they would have much more than me, but, you know, it was pretty clear to us that it was the same bears coming back. It was a sow and two of her almost full-grown cubs. And, of course, when they find a cache of food, they will come back.
The teachers yesterday involved, you know, in this attack used bear spray.
Yeah.
Our CBC colleagues are reporting a bear banger as well. Is there a way to stay safe, or when you, I mean, you live in an area that is known for bears and grizzly bears in particular. So do you, have you changed the way you behave over the years because of that reality, or is it something that people become used to and maybe forget or ignore?
No, I would say that toward the end of the year, as we're getting into autumn, there were more bears in Boulder, from just my anecdotal own personal experience and talking to people. And certainly I stopped running, because I usually go for a run in the day, and there's no way. There was a sow and a cub somewhere around, so that stopped. So as soon as there's cubs around, you know, we just don't go out and do things very, very much. But we do assume that sticking close to home and making lots of noise, that bear spray might protect us. So it's pretty terrifying if that isn't the case, because what more is there? I don't know.
To let our listeners know, British Columbia banned all grizzly bear hunting in 2017, with some exceptions for First Nations. The province drafted a plan for grizzly bear management a couple of years ago in 2023. And at that time, some conservationists were in opposition to that, because they were worried that it might eventually lead to the return of trophy hunting. You know, you mentioned that there's that strike, staffing is an issue, the number of traps you raised is a concern for you, but what would you like to see from officials there in Bella Coola or the provincial government to try to stem what is happening?
Certainly. I'm glad that trophy hunting and grizzly bear hunting is illegal now. But, you know, what I do know, again, anecdotally, is that people are terrified to, if a bear is coming too close and so on, even shooting the bear with rubber bullets would be something that someone would be terrified now of doing, because they could get a very hefty fine for that. And I'm not saying that the answer is to let them do that, but I think there really needs to be some discussion, because, again, I think it's a matter of time before someone loses their life with what's going on. You know, it might not be this year, it might be next year, whatever. But the bears are really bold and apparently pretty desperate. And I think most people in the valley really respect bears, but when it comes to a human life, then we need to make sure that people are able to protect themselves, taking precautions.
Tanis, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Tanis Monroe lives in Bella Coola Valley in British Columbia. We reached her in Toronto earlier today. Johnson Boy by the Grant Brothers, recorded in 1928. Only a handful of physical copies on vinyl have survived into the 21st century, and the man who saved that song from oblivion and thousands of songs like it was the legendary record collector Joe Bassard. He passed away a few years ago, but for most of his 86 years on the planet, he hunted for old records, traveling back roads and knocking on doors, eventually building a collection of tens of thousands of recordings, mostly blues, bluegrass, and Prohibition-era jazz. And now anyone in the world with an internet connection can dig through that collection. The nonprofit music preservation organization Dust to Digital has partnered with the University of California Santa Barbara Library to make its entire archive, including the Joe Bassard collection, accessible to all online. Lance Ledbetter is the co-founder and co-director of Dust to Digital. We reached him in Atlanta, Georgia.
So Lance, knowing now that all that work has paid off, these songs are available to anyone as a Wi-Fi connection. But it used to be that the only way was to be invited into Joe's basement in Maryland. You had that kind of invitation. You made that trip. When you close your eyes and think back to being in that basement, what comes to mind?
I just remember, let's see, when you walked down the stairs at Joe's house into the basement and he'd open that door, it was like being teleported back in time. You smelled the old records. the old artwork, the old posters and photographs, and then all you could see as far as your eye could go down the wall was floor-to-ceiling records. I just remember Joe had a big smile on his face, and he said, "What do you guys want to listen to first?" And there we went. He just almost like put on a show where he would just sort of be the DJ and keep playing things for you, get you more and more excited. He would get excited. I think he was locked in on showing us things that he had come across listening, like, hey, you can hear the engineer at the end of this record, and you can hear the artist. He says a bad word after he makes a bad note at the end of this record. And, you know, he liked to sort of surprise you with things he had sort of noticed in his records. But then as he played more and more, I think he got more and more the rare records out. Yeah. And so these were records you had to, like you said, you had to be in this basement to get to hear them. They were, some of them were the only known copies.
I want to play one of those songs, those rare songs, for our listeners. This one is from 1927. It's called Original Stackolee Blues by the Down Home Boys.
Thank you, was bully. He bullied all his life. Well, he bullied to Chicago town with a 10-bed pocket knife. And it's called Stackolee.
This is one of those songs. The only known copy of that song in existence is that one. And I think a lot of people just, we just assume now that there are archives and backup copies, master recordings out there. How often is it the case that there are songs and records like that one that without collectors like Joe would be lost forever?
More than you would think. Back in that era, so that like you said, that was made in the 1920s. The record industry was not even called the record industry. It was just, they were trying to sell Victrolas. And so it was more of a tangential industry within the furniture industry. And so their goal was to try to make records that people would come in, they'd buy the Victrola, and they could take some records home and listen to them. Even today, I would say less than 5% of the music from the 20s and 30s The original master recordings still exist. They were discarded, thrown away. And so, you know, somebody like Joe Bassard goes out and in the 1950s and early 60s and saves this music. And at the time, I think he was just excited to get to hear these songs. He didn't realize that he was actually getting, like you said, some of the only known copies that we have. And if, like that track you just played, it's never turned up, except the one that Joe found.
What did he think about newer music?
he did not mince his words. He I think he called rock and roll the cancer of music.
Oh,
and,
come on, Joe.
I know. I think he always felt like, you know, he would go, I remember he would tell me if he went to the gas station, and I think it drove him insane when the speakers at the pump, the gas pumps, would play rock and roll, and he'd say, it's a barrage, I can't escape it. But now he had the very specific beliefs on when he thought certain genres ended, like country music. He felt like when Hank Williams Sr. passed away, that was the end of country. He thought drums did not belong in country. I mean, he's just very opinionated and
specific.
I didn't agree with a lot of those statements, but at the same time, you know, everyone's entitled to their perspective.
You could debate him, I'm sure, as you're listening, but then while appreciating. Yeah, you never tried debating him. He wanted the invitation to the basement.
That's right. You know, I let Joe get it off his chest, and then I'd say, well, let's hear another record, you know.
And what do you think, given that side of his personality, what do you think he would think about this collection being available to everyone and available online so they can listen, whether it's in their basement or wherever?
Yeah. You know, when we put this this idea to him, it was in 2011, and it was all laid out. Like, we you know, he knew what he was signing up for. We were, our foundation, the Dusted Digital Foundation, was going to digitize his collection so that people could hear it on online database. And he knew that. And I think, you know, it took us a lot longer than we had hoped. And sadly, Joe passed away in 2022. Mm-hmm. So he never was able to see this this part of the project where people are getting to hear it. And, you know, I wonder if, you know, I think Joe, like his main objective, I believe, through his radio shows, and he'd make cassette tapes for people, send them through the mail. He wanted this music to be shared. And so I believe the fact now that anyone can hear it, I think he would be really happy about that.
Lance, it's been a pleasure. I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil. I appreciate the invitation, and thanks for your interest in this project.
Lance Ledbetter is the co-founder and co-director of Dust to Digital. We reached him in Atlanta, Georgia. In the movies, there's only one guy in Gotham City who wears a molded rubber suit with tall, pointy ears and his own logo on the chest. And yet, repeatedly, criminals are like, "I'm sorry, and you are?"
"What are you?"
"I'm Batman."
"What the hell are you?"
"I'm Batman."
You are?"
"Yeah. I'm Batman."
"The hell are you supposed to be?"
"I'm Vengeance."
Now, the Batman effect sounds like the name of a phenomenon where you start talking like that. Or where the barista asks your name and you say, "I am Vengeance." When they put your pumpkin spice latte on the counter, it says Benji. But that is not what it is. The Batman effect is when people become kinder and more altruistic in the presence of Batman. Don't ask me what I'm talking about. I didn't do it. Psychologists from the Università Cattolica di Sacro Cuore in Milan did it. And here's exactly what they did. They sent a woman who appeared pregnant onto the Milan subway, and they monitored how many people offered her their seats. Then they sent the pregnant woman onto the subway again, but this time, Batman, probably just someone dressed as Batman, entered the same subway car through a different door. When Batman was not on the car, 37% of people offered the woman their seats. When Batman was there, 67% of passengers gave up their seats. Now, the researchers say this suggests that unexpected events cause people to be more pro-social, that the surprise makes them reassess their surroundings. It might suggest that, but I suggest that it suggests that people are respectful of Batman because he is Vengeance. Try sending someone dressed as Garfield on the train next time. He's not Vengeance, unless you have lasagna. Where was I? Right. No one gives up their seat because of a surprising Garfield. In conclusion, science can be confusing.
"I don't know who he is behind that mask, but we need him, and we need him now.
Known as Bruce Wayne by day, wealthy socialite, but incognito in dress, he finds crime by night. Yeah, it's Batman and Robin, Boy Wonder at his side. Hey now, Riddler, Penguin, Joker, better go and hide. We need the Batman. Sweeps across the midnight sky. Somewhere in Gotham City, it'll find the Batman's eye. There's a crime wave going on, but not for very long, 'cause the Batman's gonna teach him right from wrong. They call him Batman."
From 1966, Jan and Dean with Batman.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, Ukraine's foreign affairs chair tells us the only way to fix the current peace plan is to delete most of it. He says he's wondering if the timing has more to do with Donald Trump's interest in a Nobel Peace Prize than it does with the actual possibility of peace.
And Jarbonara. Italy's agriculture minister demands an immediate investigation into the presence of a grotesque parody of carbonara sauce in a jar at a store within the European Parliament, which reminded us of another carbonara-related kerfuffle. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
We need the Batman. I must be a creature of the night.
black, terrible.
It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens. The CBC program here on KAXE KBXE People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host Alyssa Ellen. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from the McKnight Foundation. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kibbe, exploring the distinctly American art form. And tune in Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. We receive support from Bridget's Pub, located in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night on Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. The City of Virginia has a Twilight Holiday Parade Saturday, November 22nd, beginning at 5:15 on Chestnut Street and 5th Avenue. Fireworks follow on the shore of Silver Lake. Now back to As It Happens.
Survivors of Jeffrey Epstein's abuse have gotten used to waiting. For years, the extremely well-connected financier dodged prosecution for abusing and trafficking girls, some as young as 14. Now, 6 years after his death in prison, dozens of women are waiting for the release of the so-called Epstein files. This week, President Trump approved a bill that orders those files be made public, but the Justice Department still has 30 days to make that happen. There are concerns that the department could withhold files that it determines are related to active criminal investigations or that invade personal privacy. Jess Michaels was sexually assaulted by Jeffrey Epstein in 1991. We reached her in the eastern part of the United States. She didn't feel safe disclosing her location.
Jess, I wonder how you are handling this latest waiting game, again, to be so close to these files being released, but they still haven't been. So how are you dealing with that?
I wanted to make sure everybody understands that though this is a waiting game in this moment, we're celebrating the win, because we know that it's been not only decades, but in this last 3 to 4 months, it's been a marathon that we have all been in, and we succeeded, and we got an overwhelming support, a mandate from the American people to Congress, and Congress agreed, and they voted with the American people. So we feel very good about that. I feel excited about it. I am exhausted. Yeah. I'm exhausted. So we haven't gotten to the point of, okay, we're in our next waiting game, because we already know that we're just at the bottom of the next hill. So we're taking a breath. As we're trying absorb the win and just get ready for, you know, bracing for what's next.
Does it feel that you're all being seen? And seen in a way and heard in a way that you had not been before?
Definitely. When you are standing in the House gallery in that mezzanine area and the votes come in to the House 427-1, and they all stand up and look up to us and start cheering and clapping, and the heartfelt support that we could see in their eyes, that is a unique experience for us. It sadly should never have happened. We shouldn't have had to be there. It shouldn't have gotten this far. It shouldn't need an act of Congress to deal with this very, very nonpartisan issue of accountability and justice for sex trafficking.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that fact, that it did take an act of Congress, that it did take you and other survivors and Republicans pushing and pushing to get the U.S. Yes. president to reverse his position on this. As you celebrate this win, do you allow yourself a moment to wrestle with that reality as well, that is what it took?
Yes, because we're forced to. You know, I did have a moment. Everybody's been asking how I'm feeling, yeah. and I, you know, I've said elated, but I also went through some pretty serious feelings of rage and sadness that we've had to work this hard. But I feel like it is a hardening and a reckoning for what we know is going to be coming next, because we've seen this playbook before. We know that there's going to be distractions. We know that there's going to be delays. The difference is we're not going into this next phase alone. Mm. We're going with Congress and we're going with the American people. One of the things Marjorie Taylor Greene said at the press conference was that it was unprecedented, the volume of calls and emails they had gotten from the American people. Unprecedented. And so we're apprehensive about what comes next, and we know we're not alone.
What ultimately might these files shed light on or answer? What can they do when they are released?
That's a great question. And every survivor has their different answers. Mm-hmm. Answers I hadn't even heard, you know, until the press conference, where I heard, you know, some of the girls are they've gone through such tremendous trauma. They're like, I just want help remembering what I went through, you know, because there's parts of it that are just blocked from my yeah. own traumatized brain. And that's a sad and beautiful step in healing. So it could be healing that we get from the release of the files. It's ultimately two things: that the people involved will be prosecuted, and that we never let something like this ever happen again. So that what we learn from these files is how it all happened and how to never let it happen again. But there's something that's really important for, I hope, that people will take out of this and start to understand. Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell were not unique in their playbook. This playbook of having young people, young vulnerable teenagers and young women go recruit other young children to be part of this ring, vulnerable, abused girls. This is the playbook of every single sex trafficking ring in the world. So the only thing unique about it is that the buyers were elite men.
There is concern being raised by Republican Congressman Thomas Massey, as you've likely seen. He's saying he's worried that Donald Trump is perhaps opening new investigations intentionally to perhaps provide cover for some of the documents that may not be released, so that you might get incomplete documents or, you know, large swaths redacted by the Justice Department. Is that a concern for you at this stage?
It is. I think we're bracing for any number of delays and distractions because this is this administration's playbook. And let's be fair. This has actually been going on for five administrations. This is something that has plagued all of them. But you know what? Now it's in Donald Trump's lap. And this DOJ's lap, and they have to do the right thing by the American people. So though I agree with that concern, I've also talked to many attorneys that are third-party attorneys. They're not with the government. They are not with any specific survivor. And they have told me they have teams waiting to be combing through these files. And you have to remember, there are survivor victim statements that were put together by attorneys. So attorneys know, the attorneys for the survivors know a lot. There are people that have combed through these files for a long time, long before this administration ever took over in January. So we know that there are people that know what are in the files, and when things are amiss, I think we're going to see whistleblowers, we're going to see leaked information, we're going to see people advocating for us in spaces that we're not in.
And will you see prosecutions? Is that the goal as well?
It is one of the goals, yes.
Well, Jess, I appreciate this. I know it's not easy to keep telling your story over and over again and to keep fighting, but I appreciate it, and I think our listeners will as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being willing to listen.
Jess Michaels was sexually assaulted by Jeffrey Epstein. We reached her in the eastern U.S. Volodymyr Zelensky is caught between a rock and a hard place. In an address to the nation today, the Ukrainian president said his country faces a tough choice: lose its dignity or risk losing a key partner, the United States. He said that in the wake of a peace proposal drafted by the Trump administration and Russia, one that reportedly demands major concessions from Ukraine. Oleksandr Mareshko is the chair of Ukraine's Foreign Affairs Parliamentary Committee. We reached him in Kyiv.
Oleksandr Mareshko, when the Ukrainian president says this is, you know, a choice between losing dignity or risk losing a key partner, what choice do you think your country should make?
Well, I'm absolutely sure that it's no coincidence that president used this phrase today, because today is anniversary of the Revolution of Dignity. And to me and to president, to Ukrainian people, the answer is absolutely clear and even obvious. We choose dignity, even if we have to lose our close partner.
You've seen the details of this 28-point plan, as I understand it. You know, little was known when we were talking about this yesterday with our other guest. We have heard that it contains concessions for Ukraine, including big ones, giving up territory, ceding territory to Russia. How are people there reacting to hearing that?
Well, we still can't believe that this is a serious plan, because it's totally absurd, to, not only to politicians, to members of parliament, but also to any Ukrainian citizen. It's absolutely clear that it's non-starter. And the only real or normal item on the whole plan is the first one. This is about confirmation of Ukraine's sovereignty. And I would leave only this first item, and I would delete all the others.
Given what you're saying, given that you feel your country would choose dignity, and that President Zelensky spoke with American officials, including Vice President Vance, about the plan today, do you see any path forward for what is on the table right now?
No, I don't see. I don't believe that this plan is workable, that it's realistic. I just believe that our president is trying to be polite, trying to be respectful with regard to President Trump. He's trying to be also diplomatical and political. And I understand that he's in favor of starting negotiations, but everyone understands that this text is absolutely unacceptable for us.
You've also said before, our listeners heard a clip from you yesterday, you know, that this is almost exactly like what you've seen before. Why do you think this is being presented now in this way?
Well, it's hard to say. There can be different versions or hypotheses with this regard. One of them actually might be that the deadline for nomination for Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, is the end of January. And maybe President Trump is in a hurry. He's trying to produce a tangible result to deserve nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize and Nobel Peace Prize. Who knows? I don't know.
Donald Trump did speak with Fox News Radio about a potential timeline for negotiations around this proposal. Let's listen to a bit of what he said.
So is next Thursday the deadline that you gave, a loose deadline for Ukraine?
Well, we have, I've had a lot of deadlines, but if things are working well, you tend to extend the deadlines. But Thursday is, we think, an appropriate time.
Does that Thursday deadline mean anything to you?
Well, it doesn't mean anything. I can make a prediction that we will miss this deadline and nothing will happen. Why? Answer is very simple, because President Trump himself has set similar deadlines on Russia, on Putin. He promised to use sanctions against Russia many, many times. He was having these deadlines countless times, and he still has these deadlines, and it didn't work and is not going to work.
Realistically, though, how much longer do you think this can go on, and that President Zelensky cannot come to some sort of an agreement? How much leverage does Ukraine have if, in fact, that Thursday deadline does mean something and they try to force your hand?
Well, the key problem is not about Ukraine and not even about the United States. The key problem is that Putin is absolutely not interested in ceasefire. He doesn't want to stop the Russian aggression. He doesn't want to stop the war. And maybe he can't, because peace, even ceasefire, he perceives as a threat to his stay in power. So that's why this is the key issue. And you see, for reaching any agreement, you should have common ground. But in this case, it's absolutely impossible because both parties, they have diametrically opposed irreconcilable interests. Russia wants to kill Ukraine. Ukraine wants to survive. How can you reach any compromise on that?
There must be, throughout Ukraine, different thoughts, you know, from the Ukrainian people about what is being floated here. Are you worried that this is going to sow seeds of division, that there might be people who say we have to accept some version of this proposal? And of course, there will be others who say we can never accept it.
Yes, the thing is that there are two key things, key values, which we should maintain in Ukraine. First of all, trust when it comes to power. And the second one is unity, because unity is our truly weapon against Russia. And of course, Russia, Putin, is trying to undermine unity within the country. Of course, in Ukrainian society, there can be different views. Again, it's natural for democracy. But at the same time, firm majority, decisive majority of Ukrainian people, they understand what it's all about. And despite being tired for almost 4 years of brutal war against Ukraine, we understand that we have no right to succumb to pessimism or defeatism, that we should continue fighting because our lives, our future of our children depends on our struggle. So we have no choice. You know, we will continue to fight no matter what.
Oleksandr Mereshko, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oleksandr Mereshko is the chair of Ukraine's Foreign Policy Parliamentary Committee. We reached him in Kyiv. The European Parliament is a place where Europe's leaders gather in pursuit of unity and diplomacy. But a recent development could put the 60-plus year-long peace project in jeopardy. In a store on European Parliament grounds, there appeared jars of a pale, creamy sauce. It was labeled carbonara. But Italy, which calls on the European Union for help in protecting its sacred culinary traditions, is adamant that it is not carbonara at all. For one thing, one crucial thing, it uses smoked pancetta and not guanciale. This substitution is so subpar that Italy's agriculture minister, Francesco Lollobrigida, has called for a quote-unquote immediate investigation. That diplomatic nightmare brought to mind another similarly saucy scandal when U.S. food manufacturer Heinz rolled out carbonara in a can. Renowned Italian chef Alessandro Pipero, also known as the Carbonara King, found that whole idea uncanny.
My opinion is, I have not problem with Heinz. Maybe I have problem with people that buy the carbonara from Heinz and say good, and they buy again.
And why do you have a problem with that?
No, because in Italy the carbonara is completely different, no? We cook pasta very hot in 8 minutes, al dente, and we dress with special fresh eggs. And then we on the top, we put the crispy pork, no? The black pepper and the fresh Roman pecorino cheese. This is the completely different. The pasta there is not al dente. The eggs is not fresh. And maybe there is not pecorino. It's completely different. Maybe it's not too cold carbonara, maybe.
So when you heard that Heinz made this carbonara in a can, how did you feel?
I think that they are the genius.
Okay, so
genius because if they invented the bag of carbonara to eat and they sell a lot of bags, they are genius, not idiot.
Okay. So you think they're genius, but they're making your famous dish and putting
in
it.
Yes. I'm a Roman man, and I love the real carbonara. But I'm not the stupid man. I love the industries about food that make money and make advertisement about the food. I will never buy the bag of carbonara from Heinz, because I like the real carbonara, like in my place to do every day. But Heinz is industrious, is genius, is business. Why not?
What is most important for people, Alessandro, to understand about the classic carbonara?
Okay, I believe that in Italy, the people that are born in Italy and live in Italy is completely different. The people from another place is not Italy. Because in Italy, there is very real tradition about food, traditional about flavor, ingredients, and they love food like to love the life and the, I don't know what to say, is very important.
What do you remember about the first time you ever had it, maybe as a boy?
I said, Mama, I want another one.
Was it your favorite?
I have two dishes that I love in my life. One is the carbonara, and the second one is a spaghetti al dente with the garlic and clams.
Ah, alla vongole.
Le vongole, yes.
So, you know,
English is better than my... Your Italian is better than my English.
That's a first for me, Alessandro. Grazie.
Thank you.
If someone gave you a bowl of carbonara from Heinz out of a can, what would you do?
I don't know. Because maybe the Heinz carbonara in Italy, the cell is not good, but in the world it was good.
Would you eat it?
No, never. But maybe I will buy it just to check, not to eat, to check.
I see. To find out what their secrets are.
I prefer Coca-Cola in the bag, not the carbonara. You agree with me?
Oh, I'm not endorsing any product.
Yes.
Alessandro, good to talk to you.
Thank you.
From our archives, that was Italian chef Alessandro Pipero talking to guest host Tom Harrington last August. To both these champions of carbonara fighting these temporary abominations, we offer this. After Hours with Non e Per Sempre. It's not forever.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Nielke Oksal. Goodbye.